All right, welcome to the Kava Ships Podcast, where we try and cut through the fog of the murk and shine a bit of light on naval and maritime issues of the day. I'm Chris Cavas.
And I'm Chris Cervello.
The Kava Ships Podcast is sponsored by GE Aerospace. Navies that need powerful, efficient, and flexible propulsion look no further than the American-made LM2500. GE Aerospace's marine gas turbines deliver unmatched performance and reliability. Explore the possibilities at geaerospace.com/marine. And by HII. HII is the designer and operator of the U.S. Navy's live virtual constructive training enterprise, the largest LVC enterprise in the U.S. Department of Defense. HII, delivering the advantage.
Coming up, managing money. We sat down in the Pentagon's E-ring this week with the U.S. Navy's top money official, Russell Rumbaugh, Director of Financial Management and Comptroller, who talked in detail about managing the Navy's $258 billion budget, how spending priorities are debated and decided, and also about his views on the nation's shipyards. It's an extended interview you won't want to miss. But first, a look at naval news this week.
30 U.S. Marines and Navy sailors were injured May 1st during what the U.S. Navy said was an incident involving two LCAC landing craft air cushion vehicles off the North Florida coast. The LCACs were from the amphibious ships Wasp and New York, who are carrying out pre-deployment exercises with the 24th Marine Expeditionary Unit. A Navy statement said there were 18 sailors and 30 Marines aboard the two LCACs. Of those injured, five were medevaced to a hospital in Savannah, Georgia. Few details have yet to emerge about the accident, which was not announced for at least 20 hours after the event.
Repairs to the assault ship USS Boxer's rudder will be undertaken pierside at San Diego, the U.S. Pacific Fleet determined on April 29th, and USNI reported the following day. It had been hoped to examine and repair the ship in dry dock, but none are available nearby that can service the 41,000-ton ship. Boxer deployed from San Diego on April 1st, more than 2 months late, with elements of the 15th Marine Expeditionary Unit, but returned to port on April 10th after issues developed with one of the ship's two rudders. The issue is centered on the ship's starboard rudder and roller bearing system, the Navy said. While Chief of Naval Operations Lisa Franchetti told Congress May 1st, the repairs are expected to take 4 to 6 weeks. After that, CNO said, the ship would, quote, continue her deployment, unquote. Meanwhile, the other two ships of Boxer's amphibious ready group, Somerset and Harper's Ferry, carrying the 15th MU, took part in Exercise Balikatan in the Philippines.
The new Chinese aircraft carrier Fujian got underway from Zhongnan Shipyard near Shanghai May 1st to begin an initial round of sea trials. The trials for the ship, launched in June 2022, will primarily test the reliability and stability of the ship's propulsion and electrical systems, Chinese media said. It's expected this is the first of several rounds of sea trials for the first-of-class Fujian, which is considerably different from China's two earlier aircraft carriers.
Salvage crews in Baltimore, Maryland, on May 2nd began removing large pieces of the fallen Francis Scott Key Bridge from the container ship Dolly. More than 182 shipping containers were removed from the ship to help clear the way for major debris removal. The Dolly struck the bridge early March 26th, causing most of the bridge's trusses structure to collapse. Meanwhile, enough debris has been cleared from the harbor bottom to allow most large merchant ships who were at port when the collapse occurred to pass through. Damage to the Dolly continues to be assessed before the 95,000 gross registered ton ship can be moved.
In new ship news, the 5th America-class amphibious assault ship, LHA-10, will be named Helmand Province, Navy Secretary Carlos Del Toro announced May 2nd. The name, Del Toro said, recognizes the bravery and sacrifice of our Marines and sailors who fought for almost 20 years in the mountains of Afghanistan. Helmand Province, like all other big-deck amphibious assault ships, will be built at HII's Ingalls Shipbuilding in Pascagoula, Mississippi.
The U.S. Coast Guard's Medium Endurance Cutter Confidence, WMEC 619, on May 2nd, was placed in Commission Special, thus ending a 58-year active service life. The 210-foot active-class cutter was built at the Coast Guard's yard in Curtis Bay, Maryland, and when it entered service in 1966, was expected to serve only 30 years. Since 1988, Confidence had been based at Port Canaveral, Florida.
And on April 26th, the 110-foot cutter Anacapa, WPB 1335, was decommissioned in a ceremony at Port Angeles, Washington. Anacapa had been commissioned in 1990 when it was expected to serve only about 12 to 15 years, rather than the 34 years it actually was in service.
And that's a look at just some of this week's Naval News.
Well, we are here at the Pentagon today. We're sitting down with the Assistant Secretary of the Navy for Financial Management and Controller, Mr. Russ Rumbaugh. Welcome to the podcast, Mr. Rumbaugh.
Chris, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and excited to talk to your audience.
This is a real treat for me, and it's a stretch for me. You are the money guy for the Navy. You're the big money person. You deal with immense budgets, multi-billion dollar budgets. I think the current Navy request is something like $256 billion.
58, Chris. $258 billion.
Sorry, I don't want to short you for that for 2025. So you have a control over and purview over an awful lot of what's making the Department of the Navy run. I would like to know, what is your trade space? Where can you make decisions? And also, where can't you make decisions? But when it comes to you, how are you interacting with the rest of the Department of the Navy?
Chris, it's a great question. And the answer is, I'm making no decisions. Nobody cares what the controller's vision of future war is. That's why we have the real people tasked with this. Most importantly, the Secretary of the Navy, advised by his senior military advisors, the Chief of Naval Operations, and the Commandant of the Marine Corps. It's their money. They're the ones trusted by the American people and by the President and by Congress to put forward the right budget allocation. What I do is run a process that helps them understand, in your words, the trade space. If they make this decision, how long a tail does it have? If they want to make that decision, what are they giving up? If they want to prioritize this, what do they need to not deprioritize? Running that process to make sure they have the best information available is the best thing the financial management community can do.
So when you're talking about allocating money, you get requirements from the department. They have needs. So a lot of those needs are standing needs. You know what they're going to be. They deal with existing equipment, existing installations, existing obligations. There are also new starts. There are new programs. And then there's research and development. So you've got all these different areas where to invest. I think every year you have to make these decisions about what are our priorities. Are we going to invest in, you know, current equipment, maintenance, operations? Are we going to do more acquisition? Are we going to do more research and development? Recently, I think the most recent budget cuts a lot of R&D, cuts a lot of aviation. That's a decision at the moment because you've got a cap. So how do you fit into that? Where are you advising?
One of my favorite definitions of what a budget is a rolling history of decisions.
A what?
Rolling history of decisions. I appreciated that you very quickly moved off the word requirements to needs. I am unconcerned by what people's requirements are. It's important to think about it. It's important to use that term. The Department of Defense has a robust requirements process. But if your requirements are 10 times what our budget is, that is not going to inform the decision very much. What does inform the decision is exactly what you're talking about. The pull, that inertia from all those previous decisions we made. We're going to have this many bases. We're going to have this many sailors. All of those come with a tail we have to pay or have a plan to get out of it, which is also going to invoke a cost. Teeing those things up are how I and my team can provide the most value to the real decision makers.
I mean, you can't be all things to all people. You have to make hard choices sometimes. Are those choices more or less up to you? I mean, do you just advise people, these are the consequences? If you do this, this is going to happen. If you do that, that's going to happen. You get to make the decision. Are you involved in that? How does the controller fit into that?
Those are very different words there you're using. They're not my decisions.
Right.
At the end of the day, they're all the secretary's decisions. But involved is a good verb. I have the fortune of having a cold comptroller's heart and know that there are a bunch of very good ideas, that we're not trading between good and bad, that the secretary is making hard decisions, choosing between this good versus that good, which means no matter how compelling it is, I can turn around to somebody and tell them, nope, it didn't go your way.
Right.
And I'm more than happy to do that to serve the bosses. I think that is part of my responsibility. I think you will find that at every echelon within my team, that they understand when the bosses make decisions, trades need to be made, and we can relay that to people.
So the FY25 budget is out. Posture hearings are taking place on the Hill. Can you give us some examples in that budget where some of these decisions had to play out? You had to make some choices, or the department had to make choices.
Oh, Chris, you're going the wrong way. Mm-hmm. The problem with the 25 budget is I'm not the boogeyman in the 25 budget. The boogeyman for 25 is the caps. Now, we can't complain about them that much. They are a national choice. The president and the two chambers of Congress agreed to this. They looked around and they made hard choices. We have to abide by those. But it did mean we are making choices that the secretary, the CNO, the commandant had to make hard choices within a certain cap, things we wouldn't otherwise do. You referred to it earlier. The biggest one we did is we took risk in our future development programs. To simplify them, the X programs. And that is a very conscious decision. And it's a conscious decision informed by the budget caps and the real world circumstances we're facing.
I think that's part of the controversy going on right now. And it's always dangerous, because there's going to be a kickback on those decisions down the road. It's not too bad for now to say we're not going to do R&D on this, but then later on, why aren't these programs happening? And people don't always understand that. That's a narrative that's difficult to put forth and maintain.
I'm not willing to grant it is a controversy.
Yeah,
I think it is so obvious what the circumstances are that we are not getting a lot of grief about that. We're also cheating a little bit. We have plenty of money to explore these future programs. It's not that we have gutted them. We have developmental funding to make sure all of the future needs are explored. But there's a big difference between exploring them and turning them into a program of record that is starting to take shape and starting to bend steel. We have delayed them becoming what's going to go into the fleet. That doesn't mean we're not exploring what we can do, how technology will advance, how we can leverage that technology to outpace our adversaries.
You're sort of the equivalent of the chief financial officer of a major corporation, but you're not. You are and you aren't. And I gather from your point of view, you've got to be frustrated at times when people are trying to run the government like a business, or trying to or expect you to do the same thing. I mean, how do you?
I'm sympathetic to your point, Chris. You laid it out very well, right? Government has multiple purposes. It does not have a single purpose. So the idea that you can just square those is not a simple thing.
Right.
But in my CFO-like hat, one of the things I'm responsible for is the audit. I came in from the budgeting side. I've been on the Hill. I've been doing think tanks, having this conversation. I was never a real accountant. Now, sitting responsible for the audit of the Department of the Navy, it amazes me how much we are not doing the work to try to get to that rigor that every publicly traded company, that every private company already has.
What do you mean you're not doing the work?
We're not auditable.
Right.
We have a great success with the U.S. Marine Corps, who through Herculean efforts just got through an audit, what they call a substantive audit, where they just managed to describe where their money is at all times. But you get large enough, like the U.S. Navy, or I'm sorry, the Navy General Fund or the Navy Working Capital Fund, you can't show where every dollar is. You have to show that you have controls in place that can give an outsider confidence that things are where they say you are. To do that, you need to have the right systems. So we're trying to migrate into modern financial management systems. But more importantly, you need to have repeatable processes. The Department of Defense is a very accountable organization. We don't lose things that go boom. But Navy ordnance is not yet auditable. We are doing it right now. We are accountable. We count up. We don't lose things. If we get nervous, we count again to make sure we haven't lost something. To get auditable, we need to just turn on a screen and say, oh, yep, it's there, and I'm confident all the paperwork is there. That's what gets us to auditable. We need to better model what everybody else has done, even as you're right, we have multiple conflicting purposes.
How do you know you don't lose things, though? I mean, that's if you were auditable, you'd be able to say that.
We know we don't lose. That's the difference between accountability and auditability. If you accuse us of having lost something, we go count it and show that it's all there. That's not the same thing, because by the time I finish counting, to know again, I need to start counting again. Auditability puts in controls that provide signals, that provide backups, that if somebody crosses that, oh, hey, we are in danger of losing this thing. That's the difference. We do plenty of work. We just need to align that work. Our poor sailors do plenty of checklists. We just need the checklist to actually lead to these internal controls.
I know this was a topic that is on the Hill right now, in the posture hearings. And I think the Commandant Smith, Marines, was just asked, how did you do it? And his response was, well, you know, you had a commandant who said, do it, which sounds kind of cool, but he's also sitting on the same table with the Chief of Naval Operations. On the other hand, he also acknowledged that the Marines are not nearly as big as the Navy itself. They're all inside the Department of the Navy, but the Marines are relatively easier. The Navy, I think you're...
But I think you're drawing a false contrast.
Okay.
We should absolutely celebrate the Marine Corps, and General Berger, the former commandant who did say it, and of course the person who gets stuck executing that was the then ACMAC, General Eric Smith, who is now commandant.
Right.
General Berger absolutely committed to it, absolutely understood the importance of being a good steward of taxpayers' dollars and demonstrating that. Luckily, he had a team who had to learn all the ins and outs, all the weird terminology we use in audit, which have very little to do with the jargon of warfighting. But the CNO is fully committed to audit too. I find no uniformed Navy leaders who are trying to buck that. It is a bigger problem. I believe we are making progress. On the Navy side, we downgraded three material weaknesses. We took three specific things that the IPA said, you're in such bad shape, I can't even tell what you're doing over there. And we downgraded those. So we are making progress on the Navy General Fund and the Navy Working Capital Fund. We're doing it because of Navy leadership. What my team right now is doing, and we're just tipping over into that, when we talk about ordnance, or another example is we are just starting to migrate the fleets into our new financial management systems. It's one thing to take our procurement commands and migrate them in. It's another thing to take the folks who are worried about getting ships to sea to sail over to the Red Sea and defend American lives and American allies and say, hey, by the way, we need to make sure our books are straight too. We, on the financial management side, need to do the work that we tee that up and say, here's the changes we need to be auditable, and here's how we're going to maintain mission and readiness. We're working to do that, and I am confident the Navy uniform leadership is ready to make those changes when we have assured them that we will get to auditability and not risk readiness.
When, I think, is your target date 2028 or something like that?
You got it. You're doing great, Chris.
Yeah.
We'll turn you into an auditor yet.
No, I don't think so. But so you're still looking 2028. It's 2024 now. What are the big challenges right now? I mean, having accomplished the smaller Marine Corps, at least more or less, where are the, why should it take four more years to do the Navy?
Two big challenges we face. The first one, internally, we are now to a point where I have some confidence. But every time we've gone to open up a system or a process, we find out, oh my goodness, it was worse than we thought. And that has always lengthened out timelines. That's one of the reasons you've had this slow not making it over the last decade plus. We're now ever greater confidence. The second, and in some ways bigger challenge, is all of the, let's call them dependencies. The Marine Corps got incredible help from the Army in counting 3 million pieces of ammunition. We got extraordinary help from DLA, who runs the program office for the financial management system the Marines are using, and we got great help from OSD in leading that charge. All of those were relatively contained problems. When we do the Navy General Fund, now we have all kinds of dependencies on outside ones. The most obvious one is the F-35, but we need contracting to change. We need sustainment processes to change. We need logistics processes to change. We need our sister services to be along. That, getting those all currently moving independently, aligned, and then testing will all be necessary before we can really land a clean audit opinion.
So your biggest obstacle right now is the F-35 program, the Joint Strike Fighter program.
I didn't say my biggest obstacle was the F-35. But yes, the F-35 represents a big event for the Department of Defense and the Department of the Navy for lots of reasons.
And that's not under your control. I mean, that's a major joint by its definition. It's a joint program. It has huge Air Force input, obviously the Marines and the Navy too, but not to mention foreign military sales. I mean, that's a very, very complex program.
Absolutely true. And one of the reasons this is a big challenge, but it may not be under my control, but it is still my responsibility to go after it. And we've had great assistance from OSD and from the program office and from those folks in acquisition and sustainment last year. What's happened in the last year is them actually coming up with a plan of how to get there. Do I think we're going to turn over some rocks and find out there's a more rot than we expected to get to auditability? Yes. But as long as we start making progress, we can eventually get there.
Okay. Let's switch gears a little bit, maybe a little more conventional area. Let's talk some shipbuilding, because it's sort of everybody's favorite topic anymore. There is a whole lot to do with the Navy that's not to do with building ships, a huge amount. But shipbuilding these days gets the lion's share of attention for a lot of reasons. Again, you're operating under certain fiscal constraints. Ships are expensive. The aircraft carriers are expensive. The Columbia missile submarine program is immensely expensive inside of all this, not to mention other submarines and everything else the Navy's trying to do. The recent 45-day review highlighted some major programs that are all behind schedule and nominally over budget. And this made headlines. People said, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. And it gives fodder on the Hill for people to rant and go, I don't understand what is happening. Who's being held accountable? And
did you actually find anybody who said, I can't believe this is happening?
I've never heard of a program that once it started was on schedule and on budget. I've never heard of such a thing. It's not an entity. Simply by existing, once you begin, you fall behind. It's just the way the process works. The process does not like realistic projections and will not prove them. So you get what you get. And yet everybody says it's a big problem, we have to fix it, and who's accountable and all this stuff. It is big money, and you know, decisions are being made, like pushing off the aircraft carrier programs. Well, you know, that's not what that vendor, Huntington Ingalls, wants to do, because it's going to make them cost more.
Okay, Chris, now we're going to back up a little bit. It's not what Huntington Ingalls doesn't want to do that. The U.S. Navy and the Department of Defense don't want to do that. We would like to field things on time and on budget. And it can and has been done. Let's talk about a couple really big U.S. Navy examples. We have fielded the P-8 Maritime Patrol aircraft on time and on budget. Even better, the Super Hornet program is nearly the poster boy for having done that. It's real easy to look back at that one because of where we are in its life cycle. But that was hard decisions made over many years to make sure that we used evolutionary acquisition processes that we made sure that cost was a consideration, not just jump into the future, but recognize. And it did come on basically on cost and on budget. So it is doable.
So I'm not so sure I'll agree with that, but for the sake of argument, sure.
Great. So let's talk about Navy shipbuilding right now.
F-18 had plenty of problems, and the Super Hornet itself was a pretty questionable situation for a while. In any case, shipbuilding. So where are you in all this?
The traditional reason the Department of Defense programs slip both in schedule and cost is because we told ourselves we would get some super fancy capability for the low, low price of a less capability. Every independent group that goes looks at it says, why would you possibly do that? There's a lot of reasons that pathology happens. What's intriguing about where Navy shipbuilding is right now is that's not what's going on. When you look at LCS in the first decade of the century, when you look at the attempt at DDG 1000, those are traditional defense programs where our appetite outran our ability to field it. That's not what's going on right now. When you look at Virginia class, when you look at DDG 51s, these are not new programs. These are not revolutionary programs that are trying to use new technology that haven't been proven. And yet, as you said, we are still finding delays in the program. What is happening? This is a different dynamic than what we usually have. The good news about that is you have everybody within the Department of the Navy lined up in a way you usually don't have. I told you the budgeteers are often the bad guys who are trying to tell people they're lowballing prices. I don't have to tell folks that because the requirers are on my team, the programmers are on our team, the senior leadership is on the team. One of the reasons those X programs, those developmental programs where you can slip into that, got pushed because everybody recognizes the importance of getting our current programs that are going to be the ones that defend this country for the next two decades, get them aligned and get them going right, which doesn't mean we're there yet. As you said, the 45-day review came up with delays across multiple programs.
It did, but when you break those programs apart, it's not the same issues across the board. It depends on the program. They all have issues. But what are those issues? What's driving them? Some of them are maybe ephemeral, in that this is a moment. Get through this phase; it'll get better. Some of them are getting worse. Is it getting worse? Are you halting the slide? Is it just going to keep going worse? You want to know that. Those are the ones you really want to know about. Others are being managed. Manage through it. Obviously, the effect of COVID and the entire supply chain throughout the universe is still messed up. And people are not out of the woods with that yet. You can argue within those programs, and the Navy does, and rightly so, about who's where in that supply chain and where's that pressure point. But they're all different. They're all a little bit different. And like the carrier seems to be mostly a supply issue at the moment, secondary suppliers. And that should work through. But others are just getting worse. Others are getting, the submarines, the Virginia class will nominally work through that, nominally.
To some extent, you're right. The 45-day review was very clear about separating out first-in-class ships programs versus those more mature programs, because that first in class comes closer to that pathology I already described. You just are trying to put too much stuff in. Your ambitions are too high for this cost and schedule you've given. But when we look at Frigate, man, this doesn't look like something that got out of hand. It has a parent design. This is a response to the LCS program. We still ran into the trouble of just using survivability standards, which who wants to stand up and not argue against survivability standards, putting our sailors at risk. And yet that caused enough of a turbulence that we are now facing delays on the Frigate program. So there is absolutely some uniqueness to each class. Frigate being a great example that it is at least related to that standard pathology. Although I would argue in a different place, and in fact I have some optimism that once we get through those initial design problems, the Frigate will be in a good place to be a mature program and to start rolling out and be that lower cost warship that we need.
I think you're right with that, that this is, the birthing of this program is not going well at all.
That was a very downbeat way to say it.
No, it's true. And the Navy did not, I think the most frustrating thing in that argument is that the way the Secretary frames all this, all these shipbuilders and all these programs have one thing in common. They're all Navy. They all have the same customer. And the customer is not part of this discussion. It's not a partnership the way this discussion is playing out at the moment. And the Navy is complicit in all this to whatever degree. If the Navy signs a contract for a design, and we're going to use 85% of the existing design and we're still working on the last 15%, and then over 2 or 3 years, that fraction inverts itself and we're down to 15% of the original design and 85% something new, well, that wasn't the plan, but the manufacturer didn't do that.
I take your point, Chris,
that Navy did that.
The Navy is common to all these programs, but you've left out that the other side is the Navy is also the only customer for all these programs too.
Sure.
That relationship is absolutely the fundamental thing. We can't just go on the open market and buy the most advanced subs in the world. We are dependent on yards who are dependent on us. That monopsony relationship is a particularly thorny one. One classic supply and demand can't just spit out the answers for. That is what we're staring at. Again, I'm the comptroller. I worry about this because every time you don't get it right, we have to redo the budget and redo the program. So I absolutely see it as part of my responsibility to be watching out for that. I am willing to be optimistic, though, because I don't sit in meetings where people are talking about pursuing unobtainium and putting at risk things. What I see is everybody looking down and trying to get to solutions. Are we there yet? No. But we are putting a lot of skin in the game. Let's talk about the submarines. $3.3 billion just passed, not for a new boat, to support the submarine industrial base in the FY24 supplemental. In our 25 request, another $3.9 billion in 25, $11.1 billion over the FYDP. You're right. The Navy is common to all of this. The Navy has recognized that. The Department of Defense has recognized that. The White House has recognized that and recognized that if we don't do this right, we will not maintain the maritime dominance that we have enjoyed for so long. So we recognize our role in it and we are putting forth that. Can I boast about another one? You talked about supply chain. The other one that gets thrown in our face all the time is workforce. Just this week, we signed an agreement between Bartlett Marine and the International Brotherhood of Boilermakers to take folks who live in the Midwest, a place we don't have very many shipyards, to take them, make sure they can do Navy shipbuilding welding, and send them out to the shipyards to help with that workforce problem. That is the Department of the Navy taking the lead to help our partners, our industrial partners, get at some of the issues that have been plaguing them.
There is an awful lot of investment going on. You're absolutely correct. In the industrial base in different forms. That is totally true. And of course, the workforce issue is something that is affecting every single yard and almost every industry. It's a cultural thing. And not
cultural thing?
Not everybody is caught up to this. It's been going on for some years. And it's again, it manifests itself differently depending on where you're talking about. Every location is different. But be that as it may, you are a student of history. And I know you're very conversant in how things were done in the past. There's an awful lot of people, I have friends and colleagues who like to talk about why can't and rant about how come we can't do we did it in World War II. How come we can't do it now? And one reason is it's not the 1930s or 1940s anymore, and a lot of things have changed. But there are different constructs that are available to fund expansions. The war was funded in large part by victory bonds. You know, there was an outside subscription that went on. That actually is something that nations have done from time to time throughout history. It's not happening now, but I'm not advocating it. I'm simply saying that there are other constructs.
Well, we need to be a little careful. Let's start there. First of all, that's because we're already getting a supplemental. We've already got our $3.3 billion. That's a significant direct investment. Second of all, we need to grapple with the concern that we might be in a 1930s moment, that we cannot say it is different. Maybe we need to recognize all the parallels. The CNO has brought this up. That then gets us to some interesting points. The Vincent Trammell Act that really expedited Navy shipbuilding before World War II, one of the key provisions in it was coming out of the Washington Naval Treaties of the 20s, we had put profit limitations on our shipyards, we being the entire United States government. The Vincent Trammell Act removed those profit limitations, harnessing all the entrepreneurial spirit of the American shipbuilding industry. Today, we just had one of our major sub-vendors do their earnings call for the quarter last week. In their marine division, they only have 7% profit margins. 7% is not groundbreaking profit margins.
In the commercial world, that's looked on with great disfavor. Yeah.
Is it looked on with great disfavor? What those 7% margins are is near guaranteed. We have bought two submarines since 2011. That same vendor has a $44 billion back order. There is a concern about us only having one submarine in the FY25 budget. We have one submarine in the FY25 budget because taking that submarine out does not disrupt the industry at all, because there is so much backlog to be gotten through. Secretary has already broached what seems to be different. Our yards don't seem to be pursuing profits. 7% is not inflammatory margins. But 7% of $8 billion isn't as good as 7% of $12 billion. In last year's budget rollout, one of my bosses, the comptroller for the Department of Defense, Mike McCord, said, "We wish we could buy three submarines." I am confident that any dollar we took out of submarines, we would put back to submarines. Why does that desire to have three submarines not lead to a more productive yard? Why is that opportunity not seized by our private yards? We consciously and intentionally rely on private shipyards. We have public shipyards that we're very proud of, we work very strong on. We depend on them for huge amounts of maintenance. But for new ship construction, we, for 100 years, have chosen to rely on private yards. And yet, even with the promise of greater profits, we are not getting the production we want. That seems to be one of the common things that shares this, not just the Navy, but that we are running into not getting the outcomes we want.
I'm spitballing here a little bit because some of the constructs that happened during World War II included the government taking over yards and any production facility that it deemed was underperforming. The government would move in, they'd just show up one morning at 7 o'clock, throw everybody out, we're taking this over, and try to get it back on the right track. Sometimes it would last a few weeks, few months, sometimes it was longer than that. There were other constructs where the government itself funded the construction of a yard. They bought some land, they built a yard, they contracted with existing shipbuilders, "You guys run it." You know, an example might be Newport News in Wilmington, North Carolina. It's a government yard built down there to churn out all kinds of ships, contract with Newport News, you manage this. That's another construct. Do you see anything like that on the horizon, or is this still? And this is sort of looking forward. Where, you know, where's all this going? Is kind of what I'm trying to get at. And is something more drastic on the horizon, or is we're just kind of nibbling away at trying to correct the existing infrastructure?
Something more drastic has already happened.
What's that?
$3.3 billion direct intervention into the industrial base. That is getting close to World War II level injections. Not just increase our orders, but help build capital expenditures, help build the facilities. That's what we're doing now. Now, we had to wait 6 months for that bill, so the money just showed up. So that hasn't gone to the yards yet. We did some things in the FY24 budget. We would tell you we had $1 billion put directly into industry if you include the workforce funding. Again, we just actually got that money a month ago. So that hasn't hit yet. But there is already a moment where our relationship with our industrial partners has changed, where we are putting our skin into the game. Use the word drastic. Some folks would worry my secretary has already been drastic when he talks about taxpayers, not shareholders. That is an interesting question. It's where we need greater partnership from our partners to help get that production outcome. I'm pretty sanguine. I know how great the U.S. Navy and U.S. Marine Corps are. I am confident the Americans will continue to be excellent. But if we don't get this production, we really are coming off pace. China has 46% of global shipbuilding. If we can't get our national security yards moving, we are in danger of coming out pace. At what point do we as Americans really worry about that? In the meantime, we've got earnings calls where they're announcing that they have a 3-to-1 ratio providing stock market incentives versus productivity enhancements. That is the tipping point we are at. The secretary is working directly with the yards. He has a new assistant secretary for research, development, and acquisition who's working hard on this issue and ran with his new NAVSEA commander the 45-day review. So yes, I do think things are afoot. I regret a little bit that the most obvious sign of that was the FY25 budget, where we only could do one sub to try to work through that backlog. But the Navy and the administration know we are part of this. Getting the U.S. to the might it needs to be means putting these direct investments in a way that we haven't seen in decades.
Okay, well, I think I have I've used up all my time here. Folks, we've been talking to the Comptroller of the Navy, Russ Rumbaugh. Sir, you've been very gracious, and I really appreciate this opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me, and congratulations on all you do.
Well, that does it for this week. As always, our thanks go out to Vaga Maradian and the Defense and Aerospace Group for their support.
The Cavaschitz Podcast is sponsored by HII. HII is a trusted defense and technologies partner supporting all services in all domains and America's only builder of nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. HII, delivering the advantage. And by GE Aerospace. Navies that need powerful, efficient, and flexible propulsion look no further than the American-made LM2500. GE Aerospace's marine gas turbines deliver unmatched performance and reliability. Explore the possibilities at geaerospace.com/marine.
Be sure to follow us at Cavas Ships on Twitter. And remember, this podcast is available on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, SoundCloud, and Spotify. I'm Chris Cervello.
And I'm Chris Cavas. Thanks for listening, and bye-bye.